Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is Don Mullally, Director of Broadcasting for WILL. Earlier this month, a key subcommittee of the U.S. House of Representatives voted to cut federal funding for public broadcasting by 45%. These cuts will be devastating for the WILL stations. Some in Congress believe public broadcasting is one of the worthiest places to invest federal funds. We hope you will call your congressmen and senators to let them know how much you support public broadcasting. But please act soon. The full House of Representatives could take final action on these cuts by Wednesday, June 22nd. For the phone numbers of your members of Congress, visit our website at will.uiuc.edu or call 217-333-1070. It's very important that Washington hear from you on whether federal funding for WILL should be cut or restored. Thank you.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.uiuc.edu. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in. In the mid-19th century, scientists began exploring the oceans. Prior to that time, the seas were something to be sailed across. Their depths were not probed. On the program today, we'll talk about how and why that changed. Our guest is historian Helen Roswadowski. She is the author of Fathoming the Ocean, The Discovery and Exploration of the Deep Sea. At the outset of Fathoming the Ocean's first chapter, Roswadowski takes us to the Cape Cod beach in October 1849 in the wake of a terrible storm that wrecked a ship carrying Irishmen bound for America. 145 lives were lost. One of the few people on the beach that day was Henry David Thoreau. He marveled at the ocean, calling it savage, unwearied, illimitable, and fabulous. We might say the same today, although we know much more about the ocean today. In the foreword to the book, marine biologist Sylvia Earle says, "The wonder is not how little is known about the ocean, but rather how much, considering the difficulties until recently of getting around on the surface, and how limited access is today, even to the average depth of the ocean 2.5 miles down. A dozen astronauts have worked on the moon, and hundreds have felt the weightlessness of space travel. But only two people have ventured and safely returned from the deepest crack in the ocean." The words of Sylvia Earle, marine biologist. And again, to quote Thoreau, fabulous. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments for our guest this afternoon, historian Helen Roswadowski. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455, 333-9455. WILL. We also have a toll-free number, good anywhere in the lower 48, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Helen Roswadowski is Assistant Professor of History and Coordinator of Maritime Studies at the University of Connecticut at Avery Point. Her book, Fathoming the Ocean, is published by the Belknap Press of the Harvard University Press. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be here.
Well, it's so nice to talk with you. This is a fascinating story. You know, you point out that the first scientific attention paid to the deep sea coincided with interest in the atmosphere, the Arctic, the jungle, and deep underneath the surface of the Earth. What led to this interest in these places at this time?
Well, I think that it has a little bit to do with the trajectory of exploration in general. I think if you look and chart the course of where explorers had been, they had kind of gotten to the end of the line, as it were, in terms of finding coastlines and islands. Most places by that time had been named and claimed, and the places that were left to explore were places like the interior of Africa, which was very difficult to for Western European explorers to get access to because of malaria, the interior of Australia, where people were not so interested in being, and then these other far corners of the world, rainforests, the deep ocean, the Arctic. I'm not sure if that's the entire reason, but the timing is very striking. The first scientific ballooning to study the atmosphere, the rise in popularity of Arctic exploration, the deep sea, it really all happens in pace.
Yeah. You know, today we love the beach, we love going to the beach, but it wasn't always so. It had been seen as a place of disaster. And you note that renowned navigators and explorers of the 15th and 16th centuries did not dally on the high seas. But that began to change in the mid-18th century.
That's right. And one of the most striking examples of this, familiar to most people who know the story of Robinson Crusoe, but may not have thought much about the fact that when Robinson Crusoe was shipwrecked, the first thing he did was turn his back on the beach and march inland. At that time, polite society did not hang out on the beach. The beach was the place where seaweed pickers and the kind of dregs of society who were the people who worked in maritime professions hung out. And ordinary people thought that the smell of the beach, which we today associate with kind of freshness and health and vigor, was kind of a rotting, kind of nasty smell. And that all changed, as you say, in the late 18th century with the beginnings of an association between sea breezes and sea water with health and the opposite of the kind of decay and disease in growing urban centers.
Yeah. Now, Europeans of the 19th century saw the oceans as a place, but as a way of reaching far places. What about peoples elsewhere? For example, islanders of the Pacific or fishermen who made their living out on the Atlantic?
Different cultures conceived of the ocean differently. There's a historical geographer named Philip Steinberg who has written about the differences, for example, between Micronesians and mariners in the Indian Ocean, communities who lived around the rim of the Indian Ocean, people in Northern Europe, Southern Europe. And the relationships tend to be some groups who see the ocean as a place of resources like Micronesia and a connecting point between places, between the islands of, say, the Pacific, places that see the ocean as mostly an arena for battle or mostly a kind of barrier between places. There's a well-known American historian who's written about the role of the Atlantic in American history, who has mused about the dual role that the Atlantic has played, both as a bridge and as a moat. So different cultures have different relationships with the ocean, and then the people who live and work at sea have a very particular and peculiar relationship with the ocean that comes from living on it and in it and not really wanting to be under it.
Yeah. Now, so the sea was of import for political and military purposes and commercial purposes, mm-hmm. whether you're in Micronesia or you're a whaler on the Atlantic, mm-hmm. You're making a living from the sea. But I'm wondering, you know, the way the sea was seen, its import for political and military purposes and commercial purposes. Did that intensify beginning mid-19th century?
Yes, and that's really the crux of what's going on in the mid-19th century. More people are making their living in, around, on, and under the ocean. More people's lives are tied up with the ocean. More people have some experience or another, or many experiences of the ocean. And let me just give you a few examples. Immigration from Ireland peaked in the mid-1850s, and so you have enormous numbers of people from Europe having at least one experience of sea voyaging. Some of those people never went back, but unlike in the 18th century, you start to have middle-class people feeling like it's okay to go to sea. The technology of seagoing became a little bit safer, and you have Thoreau is such a great spokesperson for American life and American culture. He and Emerson have various quotes about seagoing and what it means to be a middle-class person going to sea. And one of the lines I love best is, I think it's Emerson's, about voyaging, saying that the cold, confinement, and noise are not to be dispensed with. And he compares the experience of seagoing to a taste for tomatoes or olives, which at the time were things that were unfamiliar, a little strange, maybe a little bit foreign, and yet somehow appealing. And that was kind of the way that ordinary middle-class people started to feel about voyaging, about seagoing, that it was an experience that one might seek out. As opposed to before the mid-19th century, you might have, of course, naval officers and sailors and whalers working on boats, but you wouldn't necessarily work on a boat unless you had to.
Right.
And what started changing was there was an enormous increase in shipping, there was an enormous increase in whaling that accompanied industrialization because you needed whale oil to lubricate the machinery of the Industrial Revolution. There was just a very expanded intensification of use of ocean resources. And so you needed more people to go to sea, and as it became safer to go to sea and you were more likely to come back, you had people like Richard Henry Dana, who was a college student who went to sea because his eyes were bad and they thought it would be healthy for him to go take a sea voyage.
Hmm. So it remained exotic, but it was much safer.
Yes, and much more socially acceptable to go to sea.
Hmm.
It began to be the kind of thing that people did for the experience. So, I mean, one of the ways that I understand this shift is it became, before this point, nobody went to sea. They went on a boat because they had to. But the idea of going to sea, and what we mean by that, people pitting themselves against nature, young men, boys becoming men, that kind of thing, that was something that was a product of the mid-19th century, this encounter with the ocean.
And also the rise in the middle class had something to do with it as well.
Yes. So it's industrialization, and it's the culture part, too, because the rise in the middle class went hand-in-hand with the rise in literacy, and writing and voyaging had always been linked through explorers' accounts. But then you end up with this situation where, for example, one of the common sailors on the Wilkes expedition, after he retired, wrote a book called 20 Years Before the Mast, which is obviously kind of a play on Dana's book, 2 Years Before the Mast. And he starts this book saying, well, I didn't know how to read and write when I went to sea, but then the book itself is as if it were a journal that he had kept from the very moment he started sailing, which, of course, he couldn't do if he really had been illiterate. And it just reminds us that writing, keeping a journal at sea is something that is that in our mind goes with seagoing. In fact, the first time I ever went on a long voyage on a tall ship, I didn't even think about it. Of course I brought a journal. And I got on the ship, and of course everybody else and all my bunkmates had journals too. It didn't ever occur to us to question the association between writing and voyaging. So it's all those things together in the mid-19th century.
Yeah. And remind us of Wilkes and the USXX.
Well, that expedition was a very famous expedition in American history, the U.S. Exploring Expedition, and it was an important one for the young United States. But more important for the study of the ocean was the expedition that followed that expedition, called the North Pacific Exploring Expedition. A lot of the same officers, the same flagship, the Vincennes, were sent out to explore the North Pacific and travel to Japan, and the focus of that expedition was explicitly to study the North Pacific Ocean. They brought one of the first deep-sea sounding devices with them, and the naturalists went prepared to collect and study marine invertebrates in order to discover new species to bring glory to the young American nation.
Yeah, so you've got manifest destiny on the land and
on the
water.
Sea, right. And the Wilkes expedition that we mostly know about is all about that. And the North Pacific Exploring Expedition, which is such a follow-up to that, is exactly what you said, the manifest destiny on the ocean.
Yeah.
In the ocean.
Yeah, this was interesting to think about as I was reading your book, Fathoming the Ocean, that the maritime industry helped foot the bill for all of this exploration and expansion.
Yes. And provided the experience of organizing businesses and organizing labor. There's a lot about the maritime industries were the big industries in colonial America, and they provided the blueprint, if you will, for so much of what went later.
And they also led to the establishment of the nation's scientific institutions.
Very, very much so. The Depot of Charts and Instruments, the Nautical Almanac Office, the Naval Observatory. And even in the private sector, when you think about some of the earliest scientific societies, a lot of those people who founded these early scientific societies and some of the first universities were people who, you know, were industrialists in Boston and Philadelphia and people who lived in these maritime communities.
What role did amateur natural scientists play in advancing marine science?
An enormous role, in fact. One of the things that's so clear when you start asking yourself who was interested in the deep ocean in the mid-19th century and why is that you see, first of all, that people start in relatively shallow water and start working their way deeper and deeper, and it starts right from the beach. The first people to start wanting to study marine organisms in the zoology, biology side of things, began beachcombing after storms because that was when unusual things got washed up on the beach, and visited fish markets and talked to fishermen about the stranger things that maybe didn't show up for sale in the fish markets but that were caught in nets. And the popularity of beach vacations, which are now very much what we think of when we go to beach vacations, but the Victorian version of a beach vacation, in addition to involving lots more yards of cloth and the bathing suits, involved learning about nature. And so a kind of Victorian family vacation would include seaweed collecting, and you wouldn't just collect the shells like my kids do, but you'd bring them home and you'd get out the taxonomic books and you would try to identify the species that they came from and try to see the relationships between the different species that you were collecting. So, and this was, you know, sort of the Game Boy, Pac-Man, you know, cable TV version of that's what people did for fun. And the other thing they did for fun was take the stuff home with them. The aquarium was invented in the mid-19th century, and there came to be an enormous industry in the city selling seawater and sea animals to populate these aquariums. But people would go to the shore, collect things and bring them home and try to keep them alive and watch them in their aquariums.
Yeah, and again, now we have, with the rise of the middle class, this is a pursuit that people can enjoy in the middle class.
Mm-hmm. More people can afford, exactly.
Yeah. There's a wonderful cartoon that you've included in the book. It goes back to 1858 from Harper's. There's a crowded beach, it's low tide, and what you see is not the face of the beachcombers, but their backsides, as everyone is bent over examining the beach.
It's very cute. And, in fact, finding that cartoon was really quite a striking moment for me because I was not looking for natural history things. I was actually looking through the volumes of Harper's that were published around the time of the laying of the transatlantic submarine telegraph cable. And, you know, I was just kind of paging through these journals to see what else was there, and I found a perfume ad for Ocean Spray perfume and made by a chemist in New York City in honor of Cyrus Field and the submarine telegraph cable. I mean, I found lots of really fun tidbits, and one of them was this. It was not associated with an article. It was sort of like a New Yorker stuck in the corner. And I thought, well, this, that people are interested in the ocean. It's not just tremendous event of the Atlantic Submarine Telegraph Cable, but it's also beachcombing. It's just there. It's part of the fabric of what society was like and interested in at the time.
Yeah. And if you couldn't get to the beach, or after your vacation, your time at the beach was over, you could pick up a book. There was all kinds of literature that involved the oceans.
That's right. There was an enormous number of popular writers who made their living writing these kind of, not just ocean books, popular science in general was a topic that people read and kept on their shelves. There's great books about astronomy aimed at little kids and stuff like that. But the ocean was just everywhere in the popular literature, in little kids' books, in books for young adults, and in books for grown-ups. Everything from sort of seaweeds and kind of popular natural history to more things connected to religion and kind of moral reasons to study the sea to the new science that came out of biogeography and eventually Darwinian thought. All of that stuff was sort of organized around and oriented around the ocean. And of course, the voyaging narratives were extremely popular. The Franklin expedition to the Arctic. And all these explorers would do a little bit of natural history collecting wherever they went. And Arctic explorers, some of them brought dredges with them. So you had some cross-fertilization between explorers who were mainly Arctic explorers, but who were also doing with of marine natural history, if you will, or deep-sea sounding.
Yeah. I think we're still interested in maritime literature today. I mean, the Patrick O'Brien novels have been extremely popular.
Mm-hmm.
And the naturalist that is included in that story, Stephen, very interesting fellow. Is he portrayed pretty accurately?
He is, actually. He probably looks a little bit more, I mean, if you're being a kind of historian of science as I am, a little more like a 19th century figure than a late 18th century figure. But that may splitting hairs. I mean, basically, I think he's a very compelling character, and he's, of course, as you might expect, my favorite character.
He's my favorite character too, and it's like, when can we get through this battle and let's get back to Stephen and Diane. So there you go. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, our guest today is Helen Rozwadowski. She is the author of Fathoming the Ocean, The Discovery and Exploration of the Deep Sea. You can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. Join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. So when did it become possible to pursue a career in marine science?
Well, it became possible about the same time as the ocean was coming into focus as a scientific object. The word scientist was coined in 1831 by a British scientist named William Whewell, who in fact studied tides, which is interesting. And some of the first people to make their living in science were people like Edward Forbes, who is very important in my story because he's kind of almost a proselytizer for natural history dredging. He thinks everybody should be out there on rowboats and yachts dredging away, collecting and studying the distribution of marine organisms. And in fact, he kind of ropes a lot of British naturalists into this project and gets people excited about it. He made his living cobbling together a bunch of different jobs, being a curator for the Geological Society collection, teaching a little bit, and then finally he got a very prestigious university professorship at the University of Edinburgh. And this mid-19th century was a time when the first natural history professorship were being created. And you start seeing some of the people in my book, like Charles Wyville Thompson, who is the chief scientist on the Challenger, was a botanist at Queen's College in Belfast, and he sort of has an academic career. Thomas Henry Huxley, who is most famous for being as historians have put it, Darwin's bulldog. In fact, contemporaries of Darwin said the same thing, sort of a vociferous defender of Darwin's ideas. He, in fact, was also the inspector of fisheries for the British government and spent a lot of time working on marine invertebrates. He spent his honeymoon dredging. I'm sure his wife enjoyed that. although she had recently taken a long voyage to emigrate from Australia, so she was comfortable being on the ocean. And, in fact, there's one cartoon of the two of them together on a little sailboat with a giant crit attacking them. So it looks like she probably did go out to sea with him sometimes for his collecting expedition.
And women were active in this business of amateur natural history.
That's right. When we were talking about amateurs, I should have mentioned that. Children, I talked about families. Children were encouraged to study marine zoology for sort of moral and educational reasons. And a lot of women were involved in marine natural history as well. Partly to do, a lot of them were writers of these books we mentioned. Some of them were purpose of educating their children, but a lot of them were very involved at a what we might today call sort of a semi-professional level. They wrote publications, they edited publications, they did scientific illustration, they worked with sometimes husbands or other relatives, sometimes scientists that they met through correspondence. A lot of scientists got to know each other by letters. And there's an example of a seaweed specialist named Margaret Gatty, who wrote popular books, but she also wrote very important, serious scientific books compiling all the British seaweeds. And she worked very closely with a British scientist named Harvey. And so who was someone she met only originally through letters and then became friends with. She was a mother of, six or seven children, and she was recovering from the birth of one of them at the seashore and was a little bit bored sitting around being pampered, and so she started walking around on the beach and collecting seaweeds.
So what happened that women kind of disappear from the story?
Well, one of the reasons women were so welcome at this point in the mid-19th century was the kind of sociability of beach holidays. The other was that when scientists started wanting to reach deeper, the first kind of vehicles they turned to dredge in deeper water were yachts, and women were also welcome in yachting circles. Not so much the racing tradition, but cruising was something that women did. There was a woman named Anne Brassey, who wrote a book called Sailing Around the World on the Sunbeam, and she and her four kids and her husband sailed around the world on this yacht and wrote a book about it. This sort of idea of women on yachts was a very normal part of the mid-19th century use of the ocean. And what changed was a partnership that was forged between professional scientists and the Admiralty to get access to Navy vessels, or more accurately, I would say, survey vessels, not so much the fighting vessels, but the vessels that went out to do the detailed survey work of coasts. And when scientists, these marine scientists, began to board these survey vessels, then there was sort of no room in terms of sort of women being socially not allowed and for reasons of job description, simply not allowed on these boats. So they were excluded at the moment at which marine science became professionalized.
Mm. And the surveyors, to what extent were they working for commercial purposes?
Very much so. I mean, they were working for government purposes mainly, but the government purposes were to make better charts. And the reason for funding better chart making was to make shipping safer, make approaches to shore safe, to encourage trade, to encourage the sort of trading back and forth of raw materials from colonies and countries that were not developed, and being able to then sell them finished industrialized goods. I mean, this is sort of still all part of the story of industrialization, tying the world closer together. And then the other reason was, and the specific reason for surveying the deep sea floor, was for the transatlantic submarine telegraph cable, the idea that you could link the old and new world and enable instantaneous communication between them.
Yeah, and that's where learning how deep the ocean is was so critical.
Right, it was critical, and then, you know, the end of the story was that maybe it wasn't so critical after all. It was a huge motivator for doing deep sea sounding work, although it wasn't the only motive for doing deep sea sounding work. One motive was intellectual. There was a very famous German explorer named Alexander von Humboldt who ran around South America and did a kind of a new version of exploration. It was very quantitative. It was very much trying to kind of get the big picture and tie in physical geography with climate studies and biogeography, trying to kind of get a comprehensive view instead of dabbling here and there. And his vision of exploration was very influential to one of the first people who got interested in studying the deep ocean, and that was Matthew Fontaine Maury, who was a Navy guy who had injured his leg. And so he couldn't really have a traditional naval career, and so he decided to try to kind of use science to create a space for himself in the Navy, and this he did very successfully. And he's very well known in certain circles for his wind and current charts, his whale distribution charts. But for the story of the deep ocean, he's extremely important because he ran the first regular program of deep sea soundings. Before his program, there were random kind of occasional soundings here and there. Sounding is measuring how deep the ocean is.
Yeah. And you know, you think of the ocean, you think one of the things you think of is its vastness. So, you know, how do you determine where you're going to make those soundings?
Well, and that's an interesting question, and shows you that some of the earliest motivations that Maury had, in addition to studying the physical geography of the sea, had more to do with shipping than anything else, because what he was doing was sending his hydrographers to go down and do some deep sea soundings around the Caribbean in areas where there were reported shallow areas or reefs that he probably suspected weren't there, and the job of these hydrographers was to either chart these reefs or rocks or eliminate them from the charts so that sailors didn't have to sail around something that wasn't there. In other words, to sort of get an accurate picture of what was in the deep water. Were there any impediments to navigation in these areas that were otherwise deep? And it was only when steamships began to be more and more popular that Maury started sending his hydrographers up to the Great Circle. Now, the Great Circle is the shortest distance between the two continents, the New World and the Old World, and it's obviously, if you're going to pay for gas, so to speak, a steamship is going to prefer the shortest route across the ocean. So it became the kind of standard steam, and they still are, the standard steamship lanes. And so Maury first sent his hydrographers up there to eliminate these reported shallow areas.
Hmm. Now, how did one, at this point in time, attempt to determine the depth of a spot in the ocean?
Well, the first deep sea sounding technology, if you will, was pretty low tech. It was commercial packing twine tied to a cannonball, and you kind of pitched it over the side. And when you thought you felt it touch the bottom, which you could do when you were on, say, think of Mark Twain in the Mississippi, you feel the sounder touch the bottom. You simply recorded the depth, cut the twine, and moved on. So somewhere down there, there are a few dozen very old cannonballs with the twine obviously long gone. But the problem with that system was it wasn't clear whether that the hydrographers could really feel the bottom or not. And so a young hydrographer, a young lieutenant working under Matthew Fontaine Maury, invented a kind of a sounding device that had a cannonball, but it had a hole bored through it, and so he attached a detaching mechanism. So we basically put a regular sounding lead with a little thing to collect some sediment at the bottom. You could either just smear on a little bit of grease at the bottom and it would pick up a few grains, or there'd be a little cup there to kind of pick up some bottom sediment. And as soon as the sounder hit the bottom, the cannonball, the detaching mechanism, let go of the cannonball, so you could haul back the relatively much smaller sounder without breaking the sounding line. And doing that enabled you to confirm that the sounder had reached the bottom. And this was extremely important, because before then, you know, these stratigraphers were measuring the depth, but they couldn't confirm that the sounder had reached the bottom. They were guessing at the behavior of the sounder underwater. And this is one of the problems, and I think that's clear if you look at the way scientists write about the ocean today. The ocean is opaque. We don't really, unless we bring a camera down and watch the instrument deploy, we have to kind of guess what's going on down there. And that started, that problem was clear from the beginning.
Mm-hmm. Although some people thought that at one time that it would be Africa and Australia that would be mapped. That the ocean would be mapped. I got it backwards.
Uh-huh.
That the ocean would be mapped before Africa and Australia, and those places were places on land, but there were many obstacles to,
mm-hmm.
to doing that.
Mm-hmm. They did have a sense, for a moment in the mid-19th century when the ocean was getting a lot of attention, that people were actually saying, gosh, we know more about the ocean than the interior of Africa. And that just sort of shows you how forbidding Africa was, with its thick vegetation and malaria, which was keeping people out, and other diseases and sort of, dark people, and the kind of whole imperialist project and the imagining of Africa to be a certain kind of a forbidding place. There was this moment of optimism in the mid-19th century when people thought, wow, we can figure this ocean stuff out. We can put a submarine cable down there. I mean, the story that's funny to me about the submarine cable is Matthew Fontaine Maury discovered the Telegraph Plateau, which was this absolutely flat, table-like, soft area that went all the way across the Great Circle Route, and he named it Telegraph Plateau because it was the perfect place put there, as if by providence, as he said, for the telegraph wires. And, of course, decades later, it was discovered that the mid-ocean ridge actually went right through what he called the Telegraph Plateau. So he missed a major mountain chain in his surveys, and yet the cable worked.
Hmm.
So it sort of reminds us that, however much we think we know, we may not know as much as we think we know about the ocean. It's a mysterious place.
Yeah. You mentioned the sounding device that John Brooke developed. There must have been a great interest in developing new instruments for this work. Was that the case?
That is absolutely the case. If you look, as I have, through the records of the United States Hydrographic Office and the British Hydrographic Office, every single voyage that went out had new instruments. There were blacksmiths on every ship. These naval officers had great technical educations, and every one of them was tinkering with releasing mechanisms and different diameters of sounding machine, of different shapes of sinkers, different arrangements to rig and deploy these sounders, and it was constant. In fact, there's almost you can capture the Brooke sounder probably only for a moment at a time, and the next person who used it changed it. And so this thing that gets called the Brooke sounder really looks pretty different in a lot of different incarnations.
Hmm. And all these folks that were working on the ocean, presumably they were all making records of what they were coming across, what they were doing, how they tackled problems. Was that a challenge for you as you researched the book?
Actually, it was a lot of what made me feel like I was understanding what was happening on deck on these boats. Because it was one of the things too that made me realize how similar oceanographic research is today as it was then. I mean, for example, today, there's really almost no such thing as an instrument out of the box. I mean, the best oceanography. Gets done when you have these technicians working with these scientists and saying, well, let's just change this instrument a little. Let's just, move this around. So that aspect of that, the kind of technology and science working hand in hand, is still very much there. And the other thing that's very much there that comes out very clearly in these records is that it wasn't always easy for the scientists and the technicians, the Navy people, to work together, the people who drove the boat and the people who were responsible for deploying the equipment. They had sort of slightly different goals and work cultures and came from different social groups and things like that. So that kind of thing comes out very clearly in the documents.
Yeah. Well, you wrap up Fathoming the Ocean by saying oceanography today retains the imprint of its origins. And you say, most of all, oceanography remains a science whose relationship to political and cultural interests continues to be dynamic.
I think so.
Well, here absent in your summing up is the relationship to interest in the ecological well-being of the planet.
It's very much there. One of the things that I feel like telling the story has done is to remind people that our relationship with the ocean is not a kind of static and eternal one, but rather one that had a beginning and had a period of intensification. I mean, our introduction to the ocean was completely steeped in the processes of industrialization and the mindset of imperialism and the idea that we should use resources and that we could know the ocean and that we could use the ocean. And I think that arrogance has continued for a long time, and I think it's been hard for us to, as a culture, to really embrace, believe the idea that there's an environmental crisis of the ocean because of the mindset that we have toward the ocean.
Hmm. So out where you are there in Connecticut,
mm-hmm.
What kind of work is being done today out there?
Well, I'm sitting on a campus with a marine and maritime focus, and we have scientists working here. We have people working on maritime policy and economics and things like that, and environmental history as well. So, you know, I think one way to look at the environmental problems of the ocean is, you know, it's a sort of bad, pessimistic kind of story. Things are getting worse. On the other hand, it seems to me that we're in a period now where more and more people are becoming acquainted with and interested in the ocean again, say since the mid-1990s. And there's been the U.S. Ocean Commission report and the Pew Foundation Ocean Report. And I think, you know, maybe it's possible since the what might have been the nadir of the North Atlantic cod stock crash to say, well, maybe people are starting to think about the ocean and understand its fragility in a way that they did not even decades ago when people were concerned about whales and things like that.
Yeah. Well, I remember as a kid, you know, in geography class, you know, the sea would be our breadbasket.
Right, right. That's
not so fast.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, people had tremendous optimism for endlessly using the sea's resources, and I think we are beginning to understand that that will never be the case.
Yeah. Now, at the institution that you're at, what's the thinking on aquaculture in the ocean? I mean, we've seen there's all kinds of debate about the salmon issue in the
mm-hmm.
North Atlantic. Now people are thinking about raising other types of seafood.
Right, right.
Is there. What's the debate like?
Well, I hear a couple of different strains. One is, you know, fish are the only thing left that we hunt in the wild, and it's silly that we do that when everything else. It's ridiculous to think that we can continue to do that at the rate we've been doing it, and that does seem clear if you look at the history of fisheries. And so a lot of people say, well, the answer is aquaculture. Of course, you turn to farming. But then the next question has to be, what do those things eat? And if they eat plants, that's one thing. But if they eat other fish that you have to then go out and catch lower down the food chain and bring to shore to feed to these other fish, that may not be sustainable. So I think there are different, it depends on what kind of organism you're trying to raise by aquaculture.
Hmm.
And that's what I hear when I listen to people, you know, in the historical ecology and the policy circles and in all the different sort of circles that I like to talk to and listen to.
Hmm. Well, there we have to leave it. We're straying past our time, I'm afraid to say, so we better wrap up. Helen Rozwadowski, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon.
Well, thank you.
Helen Rozwadowski is the author of Fathoming the Ocean, the Discovery and Exploration of the Deep Sea. She is Assistant Professor of History and Coordinator of Maritime Studies at the University of Connecticut at Avery Point. Her book, Fathoming the Ocean, is published by the Belknap Press of the Harvard University Press.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580.
It's 8 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Do we have Dave or Todd with us today?
Yeah, it's Todd with you today. Yeah, I've been taking Mondays off, or trying to take Mondays off as we go through the summer schedule, but that doesn't seem to happen. Yesterday, I managed to make it up to the Illinois 4-H Expo. Big thanks to all of those who made it out to that. I think there were roughly 500 of them there at Funk's Grove outside of Bloomington, Illinois, this week, all week long, in fact, or a good portion of the week. The American Grasslands Council is meeting in Bloomington, so that's one of the events that's been happening through the week. 4-H Expo is an annual event that's sponsored by, in part, by University of Illinois Extension. A lot of Extension folks up there. One of the more interesting things, and I'll just throw this out before we get to the numbers very quickly, is that there was a representative there from the Brookfield Zoo, and they were looking to contact some producers directly to provide for their grass and hay needs at the Brookfield Zoo. Of course, many of those animals, the hippos, the elephants, several others, giraffes, zebras, eat quite a bit of forage, grasslands. They'd be grazing animals, and so they look to fill those needs from the farmers right here in the United States. Speaking of farmers here in the United States, that's the way the futures finished the day at the Chicago Board of Trade. An up day across the floor, the beans were up 9 cents, and the nearby is the deferred November, up 10 and a quarter. For the day. We'll take a look at those complete numbers momentarily. July wheat, the harvest month at 317 and a quarter on the high, the low at 310 and a half, and a settlement price at $3.16, up 2 and a quarter. September futures, 327, the high, the low at 320 and a half, and a settlement price at 326 and a quarter. They were up 2 and a quarter as well. December futures, 338, the high, the low at $3.32, and the soft red winter December wheat settled $3.37 and a half. They were up 2 and a quarter on the day. The March contract, a 348 high, low at 342, settlement price at $3.48. They were up 1, and the May futures at 351, the high, the low at 348, settlement price at $3.51, up 2 and a half of the day. From the corn pit, July futures 4 cents higher today, $2.19 the settlement price, the high at 19 and a quarter, the low at 13 and a quarter for the July contract. September futures up 3 and a half today, 228 and three quarters the high, the low at $2.23 and a quarter, settlement price at 228 and a quarter, and the December contract at 239 and a half high, low at $2.33. settled 238 and three quarters. They were up 4 for the day. March futures 247 and a half, the high, the low at 241. Settled 241 and a quarter, up 4 and a half. In the May contract at 251 high, low at 246 and a quarter. Settled $2.50. They were up 2 and a quarter for the day. July futures in the corn pit for next year, 254, the high, the low at 250. Settlement price at $2.53 and three quarters, and they were up 1 and three quarters for the day. Oat futures now, July contract 152, the high, the low at 146. And a half, settlement at $1.52, up 4 and three quarters. In September futures, up a nickel today, 156 and a half the high, low at 151, settled 156 and one half for the September oats. July futures in the bean pit, $6.95 the high, the low at 676 and a half, and a settlement price at 689 and three quarters. They were up 9 and a quarter today, and that 695 is getting very close to the top end of that market. A double top that we talked about last week, in fact, with Dan Zwicker. So this would be a triple top if it actually doesn't go through it. But of course, who knows what's going to happen at the Board of Trade if the rainfall holds off. August contract, 696 the high, the low at 679 and a half, settlement price at 693 and a quarter, up 10 and a quarter. Other things, of course, the soybean aphid and Asian soybean rust possibilities out there as well. September futures, 701 the high, low at 684, settlement price at $6.96 and a quarter, up 9 and a quarter. And November contract, listen to this, high $7.09 through the $7 mark today. On the high, the low at 690, settlement price at 704 and three quarters. They were up 10 and a quarter today. January futures 707, the high, the low at 691 and a half, settlement at 704 and a half, up 10 and three quarters. In the March futures, a 696 high, low at 683, settlement price at 691 and a half. They were up 5 and a half for the day. Bean meal now, July futures 221.10, the high, low at 216.80, settled 220.90. They were up $4. August contract up $3.90, 221.60, the settlement price 221.80, the high, the low at 17.70. July bean oil 23.28, the high, the low at 22.95, settled 23.25, 24 higher, and the August contract at 23.39, high, low at $23 even. Settlement for that August bean oil at 23.29, and it finished 19 higher. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Okay, we saw some recovery today. For cattle, August feeder cattle, the high 109.80, the low 108.60, the settlement 109.25, that up 77 and a half. September 108.70, the high 107.50, the low 108.37 and a half, the settlement, that finishing up 87 and a half. October feeder cattle 106.97 and a half, the high 106.05, the low, the settlement 106.50, that up 55. June live cattle 83.22 and a half, the high, the low 82.50, the settlement 82.90, that up 60. August live cattle 81.15, the high 80.50, the low 80.67 and a half, the settlement, that finishing up 32 and a half. On to lean hogs. June lean hogs, the high 67.92 and a half, the low 67.60, the settlement 67.62 and a half, that down 10. July 69.50, the high 66.90, the low 67.32 and a half, the settlement, that down 147 and a half. August lean hogs 68.20, the high 65.85, the low, the settlement 65.97 and a half, that down 187 and a half. October lean hogs 59.80, the high 57.50, the low 57.67 and a half, the settlement, that down 182 and a half. And July belly 69.35, the high, the low 66.90, the settlement 67.05, that down 170. The Dow is up 19 points at 10,541. Okay, got it there. And the S&P 500 is up 2 points at 1203.
Today's programming is made possible in part by Ratio Architects, designers and planners, dedicated to distinctive projects for higher education, lifestyle, and cultural clients. On the web at www.ratioarchitects.com.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Michael from Andalusia, Alaska writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why do girls like boys more when they're not being noisy?
Girls..."